Hello, Zoomies. I don't know if I'm quite on your camera yet. It's lovely to have my mum with on Zoom again. Hello. I think she was there a minute ago, though. She is still there. Yes. And I was a little bit worried that many people this morning might think it's raining, I'll just Zoom in. But I mean, I'm delighted that so many people have come out in the storm to be here in person. I think we are valuing in person in a way that we maybe didn't before, having not had it for a while. So, Acts 12. This is a story straight off the felt boards of Sunday school. There's a tyrant king, there's an angel, there's a prison break, there's a midnight dash through the streets, there's the tense wait outside the gate while the guards might be coming to see if they'll let them in. And then there's prayers answered, there's great rejoicing. And the bit we didn't read is also that it follows on that Herod the tyrant king is struck down dead in a public ceremony in the end of the chapter. As in, he's in a public ceremony and he's struck down dead. Not that they have a public ceremony to strike him down dead. That didn't come out quite right. So at face value, the meaning of this story seems to be something like God is triumphantly powerful, evil will never win, pray very hard and miracles will happen if you pray with fervent prayer. Is that the story that you've heard this spoken about? If you've heard this story, to be honest, I'm not sure I've heard this story really spoken about. It's sort of taken as this just tells you what it tells you, don't say very much. So those things I think could be true, but I'm going to today talk about two alternate ways to read this text that are quite different and I think bring out quite different things. And I think there can be multiple layers of how we read a text that can all be true and that can be more or less true for us at different times depending on what we need. So I'm not giving you two different ways to read it so you can pick the true one and chuck out the false one. I think these are ways that we can read the text at different times. So the first way that I'm going to suggest we can read this text is as a comedic critique of the church. Now, we are probably quite uncomfortable with seeing the Bible as being funny because most of us were taught to take it as deadly serious and definitely not laugh at it. This is an attitude that equates humour with frivolous amusement. But good comedy is often deeply serious. A good comedy tears the mask off a polite society and reveals the truth, often the truth that the powerful hide behind with their seriousness. The truth that is hidden by a serious front, a comedy will tear off. So hear this story as if you were listening for a comedy. Here is Peter in the wee hours of the night before he's scheduled to be executed by the tyrant King Herod. And Luke uses Herod to deliberately blur a whole lot of different characters into one persona of the evil king opposing God's people. Between Luke and Acts, there are four different King Herods, and they're almost all just called Herod, which is deliberately trying to make you see them all as this evil thing rather than specific individuals. So he's a literary motif. There was a real Herod. This was probably Agrippa 1, but he's used as a literary motif, the tyrant opposing God. So, Peter, the great apostle, the leader of the church, at this most important moment, is asleep. In fact, he's so sound asleep that the blinding light of an angel doesn't stir. So the angel basically kicks him in the ribs. The traditional reading would say the reason Peter is asleep here is because of his pious trust that whatever happens in the morning, God will be with him. He doesn't need to worry all night. That's true. There's a bright light. There's a fierce blow. Peter, still a bit groggy. So the angel gives him instructions that sound a lot like me getting the kids out the door to school in the morning. Have you got your shoes? Get your jumper. No, you really need a jumper. No, go and get your cloak. It's really cold outside. It's the middle of the night. Have you got... Tie your belt. Your pants are falling down. This is what we've got, the angel telling Peter in the middle of the night. Richard Pervo, in his commentary, said, this angel could be called the patron saint of nannies. He says, one is relieved that Peter is not admonished to wash his hands. Now, of course, we'd have the angel singing Happy Birthday twice. So off they go. Sleepy Peter with his angel. The gates, the chains, everything just melts out of the way. They're in the darkness. Angel disappears. And Peter finally realises that he's not dreaming. And he says something like, "By gum, I think the Lord has saved me. Hi, diddly ho." It really is. It really is. Now, I, as an independent 21st century woman, think it's very practical that he then goes to the house of a woman nearby. But I think for a patriarchal audience hearing this, it is intended to add to the comedy that the escaped convict on the street with guards after him goes to a woman's house. And apparently all the male leaders of the church are in hiding, so he can only find women and a group praying to try to get help from. And Peter meets a slave girl at the door who's so excited she shuts the door in his face and leaves him outside. The text says there were four sets of guards. There's 16 guards guarding Peter. This is deliberately saying how big the force behind him is. He's standing in the street, 16 guards, two of whom were chained to him, might notice he's missing at any minute. And the church shuts the door to him. All the other things, the prison, the chains, everything just fell away, but the door into the church seems impossible to get in through. This is the first point where I think the comedy is having a bit of a dig at the church. And I think it sees for us, this is my first question for those of you who don't want to listen to it all but want to sit with something. How hard is it to get into our church? Beyond the friendly greeting, we're so excited if someone walks in our door. We're very nice to them on the first day. But how good are we at letting people get deep inside and into our trust to become our friends? You might just want to sit with that as your piece from today. Rhoda, the slave girl, is sometimes described as a flighty girl. The words, she's a female slave, there's nothing to say she's a girl and there's nothing to say she's flighty. In fact, I think she's the most solidly dependable character we've got. She's the doorkeeper to a house where a persecuted minority is engaged in a potentially illegal nighttime meeting. I think she's probably under very firm instructions not to let anyone in without the specific say-so of the householder. And she's not making an exception for Peter. And I think this is possibly just giving them a nudge to say, if you're going to keep slaves when you're a Christian household and leave them under strict instructions where you have all the say-so, well, you might have to live with the consequences and have your apostles stand on the street while they wait for your say-so. And then we get this lovely farcical scene, which Hannah did so beautifully. The Christians are praying for Peter. And Rhoda comes to tell that Peter is there outside. And it's, "Oh, Father, please we beseech you for our brother Peter, who's in chains, that you might release him." Oh, Peter's at the door. No. "Please that you might set him free. Send your angel of light." Your angel of light brought him out the door. No. It's just this lovely juxtaposition of the praying church not willing to listen to the messenger to tell them that their prayers have been answered. This is a common piece from a Greek comedy. It's the Greek comedy regularly has someone knocking on the door who can't get in. And it often has a character who's a slave, who is the messenger between the person outside and the people inside. And the way Greek comedy works is that the slave is the one who sees what's really going on, and therefore through the slave the audience sees what's really going on, and the person outside is frustrated and the person inside is blind. It's a flag to tell us this is intended to be comedy. It's using one of the great comedic tools of the time. Peter's outside getting in quite a panic at this point. It's getting near dawn. There's 16 guards at any point going to notice he's missing. He's trying to be invisible because he is an escaped convict, but he's also beating louder and louder on the door. So the question sits whether the Christians will notice he's there before the entire street comes out to see what the racket is. And there is poetic justice in this scene. We last saw Peter encounter a slave girl in the courtyard of the high priest the night Jesus died. And that slave girl also recognised Peter. And that slave girl was very persistent in making sure she identified Peter. And Peter tried to shut her up until her genuine seeing revealed the truth of Peter's difficulties in following Jesus. Now Peter really needs this slave girl to be just as persistent and to be just as accurate in her identifying of him. On the morning of the resurrection, the women went to the tomb, discovered it empty, ran to the disciples and shared the news that Jesus had risen. And the disciples did not take their word for it. Many of them didn't believe them at all. Peter, to be fair, did actually at least go and check the crazy claims and go to the tomb. But on the whole, they didn't believe when the women came and told them. And now Peter is suffering the effects of a community that continues to not trust a message brought by a woman. Finally, the noise gets through and the prayer group comes to the door. They wouldn't listen to the slave, so now they have to take the role of the slave and answer their own door. And they nearly faint with surprise because they had no... It doesn't seem that they at all conceived that if you prayed for Peter's release, the result might be Peter's release. The word is that they're quite beside themselves. They're out of their mind with surprise. Similar to the language they told Rhoda, she was out of her mind. They're sort of hysterical as a group. Peter has to flap at them to tell them to be quiet so he can do a little doorstop speech. And then the great Peter, miraculously saved by God, goes on the run. He goes into hiding. He gives a quick nod to James, let James know what's going on. James becomes the leader of the church in Jerusalem. Peter barely ever appears in Acts again. He's only got one cameo appearance in the rest of the story. This is his exit. Peter's exit story is this comedic account of him disappearing into the night. If this is a comedy, it's not intended for light amusement because it's wrapped by death. At the start of the chapter, James is executed. At the end of the chapter, the guards are executed when Herod finds that the prisoner is gone. And then Herod himself dies. So it's not meant to be just a bit of a laugh. But it does pull aside the mask of the heroic Jerusalem church that we get in Acts. The church that is the community of perfect sharing, faithfulness, apostolic leadership. Well, the apostolic leadership here is dependent on a slave girl, the least powerful character in the whole story. The faithful community doesn't actually believe the things they're praying. The community that is supposed to be living as equals, giving all they have, sharing, is meeting in the house of a wealthy woman who still has slaves. But none of this is presented as a harsh critique. It's presented with the loving gaze of shared humour. It's the church laughing at itself, laughing at the ways that it bumbled along, figuring out how to follow Jesus. What parts of our church life together do we find easy to laugh at? And what parts of our church life, if somebody laughs at it, we get quite prickly? And is there truth in the things that we get prickly about if someone makes fun of us, us here at Mount Hawthorn Community Church, not us in a general sense? The things that make us prickle are often the places where maybe there's a little bit of truth in the humour that someone's putting at us. And who are the Rhodas amongst us? Who is trying to get your attention to see what's really there? Probably not the people we esteem the most. Who has tried to get your attention in this last week, in person or through the news, that you were inclined to dismiss or ignore? Maybe this week you can go from here to particularly listen to the voices that annoy you and the voices you're inclined to dismiss. Now, while it's possible that the early church lived so surrounded by violence that it was able to find humour even in the midst of death, the problem I have with this reading and also with the traditional readings is that it doesn't answer the question, why Peter and not James? There was no prison break for James, no angels, no praying church with a miraculous James brought to them. Surely James, son of Zebedee, one of the original 12, like Peter, one of the inner circle, Peter, James and John, surely he could have been saved. Surely the church prayed just as hard for him as they did for Peter. But he seems to become an introductory illustration just to show how dangerous Herod really is and how under threat Peter really is here. And what about the guards who die? It was common practice that if Roman guards allowed their prisoner to escape, the guards would then be subject to the punishment the prisoner had been liable for. So whatever the prisoner was in for, you finished their sentence, basically. It's not, Herod was prone to random acts of violence, but it is not a random act of Herod's violence to kill the guards. It is the working out, the expected outcome of a prison break for a prisoner who was on death row is that the guards will be on death row. So they may just be mentioned so that we know for sure Peter really was under a death sentence and nothing else. But it is still very disturbing. Just take a moment to sit with that discomfort. And especially to sit with the discomfort of the unfair deaths that you carry with you. And I know in this room that is very hard for many of us. I want to propose another reading of this text that I think holds this. And this is to read it through the lens of Passover, Exodus, and resurrection. I have actually written in my notes, paradigmatic tale, what was I thinking, of liberation and resurrection. Never use a word like paradigmatic when you're speaking, just don't do it. This story is laden with the imagery that links it to Exodus, where God rescued God's people from slavery in Egypt. We're told it takes place at the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. It's part of the Passover. That this Peter is imprisoned through Passover. Herod doesn't want to kill him at Passover because he might get in trouble. So he's got him in prison so he can kill him after the festival is over. And the angel gives commands that are very similar to the language used in the Passover liturgy. The pieces that Lyndon read us from Exodus echoed some of that. Strap on your sandals. Tie your belts. Get up quickly. Follow me. This is not actually nursemaiding humour, or not only nursemaiding humour. This is Passover liturgical language. And Peter's words, once he's outside, echo what Moses and Miriam say to explain the escape from Egypt. The Lord has rescued us from the hand of Pharaoh. Peter says, the Lord has rescued me from Herod's clutches. It's the hands in this are everywhere. A pillar of light leads the way, but doesn't lead the way straight into paradise. It leads into a wilderness of confusion with a stubborn people. Peter struggles to get his community through the message to his community, much as Moses struggled and struggled to get a message through to his people in the desert. Miriam led the celebrations after the people crossed the Red Sea. Miriam is the same name as Mary. Peter goes to the house of Mary, and that is where the celebration takes place. The great joy when the freedom is recognized. And Pharaoh's army are killed as part of the process of rescuing God's people. And so Herod's soldiers are killed as part of Peter's escape. When this passage is read aloud, I'm told, it even sounds like Exodus. It is full of words that start with the prefix ex, which means out or out of. So when you read it, you hear out, 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 out as part of how it sounds. Now, Exodus is the foundation of Jewish identity. And one of Luke's big agendas in writing Acts is to show that the community of Christians continues that identity, that the Christians that Luke writes to are the people of the liberating God. As God has always rescued God's people, God will continue to rescue God's people, those who trust in Jesus. But for Christians, the extra layer to Exodus imagery is that Exodus and Passover are now completely entwined with resurrection. Because Jesus is killed at the Passover, and Jesus, through his resurrection, brings us into a new Passover and a new Exodus, not from literal slavery, but from death. Death is the prison. Death is the great tyrant. And Peter's escape story just drips with imagery of death. He is asleep. This is a word that is used for people being dead. He is in chains, also imagery used for people being dead. The angel strikes him. The word used here is really violent. It's the word used elsewhere for a death blow. The angel strikes the firstborn of Egypt. Same word. He strikes. Peter is struck by the angel. At the end, Peter departs and goes to another place. This is also an image used for people dying, not just by us, but at the time. And Peter, as I said, only appears once more in Acts as a kind of cameo when they're deciding what rules the Gentiles need to follow. Some commentators have even suggested that this passage does not describe Peter's release, but Peter's death, which otherwise is not in Acts. That Peter's death has been overlaid with a theological interpretation to say that his death was a death into resurrection, not an end. So whether Peter actually escaped from a literal prison, or whether this is an allegorical way of saying that when Herod killed him, he really escaped into resurrected life with Jesus, what this frame gives us is a way to hold James. Because this is a community being told, our God is a God of resurrection. Jesus' resurrection was not a once and never again event. The Exodus is not just an event in the past. We are the people of God, the God who sets us free. And that includes setting us free from the greatest tyrant, from death itself. And so, like Peter, our stories are retellings of the great narrative of resurrection, life out of death. And James belongs to the same story. While he was dead, somehow he also lives. So it's not a sad, unjust story of James who died and Peter who is saved. It's a story of James and Peter and Jesus and you and I and every beloved one we carry in our hearts. Every one of us who die, and yet somehow by the power of God, who is the God of liberation, we also live. And however much we want it to be true, trust it's true, live in response to hoping it's true, at some level it is still impossible to grasp. And so when we gather, we are much like that community gathered at prayer, who prayed, I think, out of their deep love for Peter, but struggled to believe that any literal rather than just metaphorical life would come out of it. I don't know what happens when we die, but I pin my hope on the God who inspires stories like this. A God of life and liberation who overturns every tyrant, even the tyranny of death. I am happy to take questions or comments. If you're on Zoom and you want to question or comment, what's the appropriate process? Wave wildly and someone will turn you up. Or possibly unmute yourself and someone will turn you up so we can hear you.
If there are questions, I'll repeat them to the microphone. Peter.
This is just mildly interesting and may or may not be true, But quite a lot of... I just noticed when I was reading that, I've never noticed it before, that he went to Mary's house, the mother of John Mark. Quite a lot of New Testament scholars firmly believe that John Mark was actually Peter's son. And the reason this isn't mentioned, there's only one direct mention in all of the New Testament, I think, to suggest that that's true, was because they didn't want John Mark to be fingered by the authorities. So if that's actually true, then it's not surprising that he went to that house. He was going home, where his family was.
Thank you.
That's maybe completely untrue, but I thought it was interesting. Tim, those of you who know Tim Finney, he's absolutely nuts about that theory. He'll give you a very long lecture on it.
Whoever said interesting, that's what I... Your framing there I just found fascinating, and I just following the framing around the Exodus, if you go to the rest of the chapter, then there's a little incident of how Herod gets killed and why he gets killed, which is like, didn't Pharaoh get...
I can't remember.
Right?
Pharaoh got knocked off in that one.
Or something. But then, so there's the Pharaoh bit, and then it says, but the word of the God... of God continued to spread and flourish. So it's kind of like, I'm going to do this anyway. And then you go to Barnabas and Saul and connection to John Mark. So there's just goes with that.
The other piece of the potential Exodus frame is that in chapter 11, Barnabas and Saul have come from Antioch to Jerusalem to deliver support because there is a famine, and the whole Exodus story hinges on famine being the reason this all began and why they're in Egypt, and that's in chapter 11, that there's famine language is used as well.
I guess one of my reflections is kind of working as I was service leading and thinking about kids and that sort of stuff, the concept of this story being a story of liberation in the sense of Exodus, which I couldn't really get my head around anyway. Like then translating that into something that children would understand was pretty much impossible, which is why we ended up with Tabby McChat. because it's really disruptive. It's a really disruptive and uncomfortable thought that in order to be liberated, it's not like this straight trajectory. It's really uncomfortable.
The amount of violence in the Exodus story is quite overwhelming. I mean, the violence in this Acts story also is extreme, but when I was selecting pieces for that very abbreviated version that Lyndon read, trying to choose pieces that gathered the heart of it without just having everyone dying all the time, and the violence, it's a violent story, it really is. But that's the nature of liberation, is that it's out of violence, that the tyranny is tyrannous. It's not a nice thing that we're being liberated from.
Thanks, Elise and Claire. That gives me an interesting reflection because, as you all know, we've been to Israel and worked with the Palestinians there. And the Palestinians, Christians, very much talk about their liberation theology. It's almost as if the story is repeating itself right there in Israel, where the Christian Palestinians are subject to so much injustice and violence that it seems it's all happening again there.
I think that's everyone for now. Anyone on Zoom holding their breath to say anything? Give a wave if you're waiting to say something. No? All right. So I'm looking at you on the wall, but I realise if I want to actually look at you, I'm meant to look here. You're over there, but I need to look here. It's quite confusing. Yeah. All right. Thank you.